Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Two riders were approaching, of course, in All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix. Two riders were approaching is also the title of a new book, The Life and Death of Jimi Hendrix, dealing with Hendrix's time in London, his arrival in the UK, a psychedelic trip, some could argue, into the dark heart of psychedelic London. Joining me live on the line is author and good friend of mine, I like to think, author of Two Riders Were Approaching. Now, normally when I say this, the line goes dead. But Mick, are you there? Hello, Mick. You are shizening me. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, Mick, this is becoming something. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys and golfers, the fates conspired to cut me off. That's the third time it's happened when I've done a blinding, in my honest opinion, Mick Wall introduction. However, as I was saying before, the technical gremlins got involved. Two Riders Were Approaching is the subject of a new book on the life of death of Jimi Hendrix. Joining me, if the fates allow, I've made the sacrifice at half time to the gods. Mick, are you there?
I am, Charles. I'm here.
Once again, make a blinding introduction and nothing happens the other end. So, my dear friend, Jimi Hendrix. Now, you would think that we had covered all we needed to know about the life and death of Jimi Hendrix. Your book takes things a little bit different, in a different look, almost like a sort of Heart of Darkness psychedelic ride into Jimmy's arrival in London. And you could say that he basically changed as soon as he sort of touched down in the UK.
Well, certainly the narrative surrounding Jimi Hendrix changes. I mean, I think if you mention the words Jimi Hendrix to most people now, unless they're incredibly familiar with the story, they think of swinging London in the 60s. They think of an accidental death from an overdose of sleeping pills. And, of course, they think of this incredible guitar player. Only the last of those is really true. I mean, the fact is Jimmy had a whole life long before he got to London. He was only, in fact, in London, living there for about a year before he went back to America and pretty much stayed there, set up home there again. He certainly didn't die of an accidental overdose of sleeping pills. And in fact, the book begins, page one, chapter one, begins with his murder. Now, as with so many of these stories, whether it's the Beatles or Dylan or the Stones, the stories get told again and again in countless books, and it becomes like an echo chamber. They kind of try and sew together the well-known points of the story. But those so-called well-known points, if you examine them and go in there close, as I've done over the last 4 or 5 years, you find it's an illusion. You know, this whole idea that Jimmy was part of swinging London, he really wasn't. You know, by the time he arrived in London, swinging London was already well underway. In fact, we were about to give way to the Summer of Love, as we called it, by which point he was already on his way back to America. And in terms of his death, that's become one of the biggest kind of fairy tales ever told in the music business. He was a guy who became empowered on drugs. You know, he would spend 4 or 5 days taking everything available to him and still creating incredible music. He had this incredible energy. The idea that somehow in the end half a dozen sleeping tablets did for him, there's actually zero evidence to support that. And in fact, the original coroner's report, if you look, describes the body arriving at the hospital at about 20 past 11 on that morning, when the body had already been dead for nearly 7 hours. And it describes the hair, the face, the shirt and the clothes being what it actually uses the word caked in red wine.
Right.
Now, two things here. Jimmy didn't drink wine. And number two, there wasn't any wine found in his stomach. However, his lungs were filled to bursting with red wine. And the only way that can happen, and when you think that his head, his hair, his shirt, everything was awash in red wine, it suggests what these days we call waterboarding, which is essentially shoving, in this case, a wine bottle pretty much down his throat. And it just literally fills the lungs, not just one bottle, but another and another and another, until he actually drowns in red wine.
Go on, after you. I'm just reeling from this one, because obviously I've heard various thoughts about what happened to Jimi Hendrix. There was a Swedish girlfriend available there. I mean, discover him? And I mean, I'm just playing devil's avocado here, Mick. But go on.
Of course. No, well, she was a German named Monica Dannemann.
Right.
And Jimmy had been with Monica for almost 3 days at that point. She arrived the same day his previous girlfriend left. And the night of his death, she drove him to a party where two other girlfriends of his just arrived from America, and he'd sent her away. She eventually comes back, drags him off in a jealous fit. But by the time they get back to her flat in London, it's 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And that's when what happened really occurred. And I don't want to do a spoiler alert.
Sure.
Essentially, it revolves around Jimmy's English manager, Mike Jeffrey. You know, again, his story seems to have been lost in the midst of time.
Yeah.
We all think that Chas Chandler, the former Animals bassist, was the one that discovered Jimmy in New York. That's not true. Was the one that really brought Jimmy to major success. That's only partly true. He was discovered in New York by several people before Chas came along, but most importantly, a lady called Linda Keith, who was Keith Richards' glamorous, rich girlfriend at the time, who had an affair with Jimmy and was the one that was responsible for getting Chas involved. But in terms of Jimmy's management, the real figure was this guy, Mike Jeffrey, who had was already managing the Animals, had already managed other people. And Mike, it's fascinating because I'd never read any of this before. He had a military background back in the 50s, was part of the original British, then evolved into MI6. He was spoke Russian fluently, had been a go-between back in the Cold War days, had been an assassin. By the late 60s, he's connected to the Gambino family, mafia family in New York. 9 months before Jimmy is bumped off, Mike arranges for guys from the Gambino family to actually kidnap Jimmy for 3 days and put a gun to his head and read him the rules, as Mike put it, because at that point, Jimmy wanted to get away from Mike, wanted to form an all-black band, an eight-piece, whereas Mike needed him to get the three-piece experience back together because that was the money-making machine. And at this point, Mike Jeffrey was millions in debt to both the Mafia and the record label because they'd built the studio, they'd committed to films and all kinds of stuff on Hendrix's behalf. I mean, I'm aware we're on the radio, so I don't want to
bore
you down with too much detail, but Mike had the wherewithal, had the means, and certainly had the motivation. And the book goes into detail to explain why. But that's really just the intro. The reason I make that the intro is to give you that warning sign that this is not the story you thought you knew.
Right.
Because after that, we go back to Jimmy's family. You know, his mother was a teenage hooker. His father was a drunk. His father sold out his kids to orphanages. You know, it's a terribly tragic story. But every part of it has been turned into a myth, this idea that Jimmy left the 101st Airborne in the early 60s because of an accident he had jumping out of an aeroplane.
Yeah.
His parachute didn't work or he landed badly. Absolutely no evidence to support that. In fact, the documentation goes into detail of how, in fact, Jimmy had declared his homosexuality in order to try and get it out of the 101st Airborne because he hated it, he couldn't stand it, it was a terrifying experience. He was only there because it was either that or go to juvenile jail after several crimes and misdemeanors at home in Seattle. And he had to keep up this idea of being homosexual for nearly 9 months before they eventually accepted it and let him go. And then you move the story on to other instances where, in fact, was he really faking homosexuality? I mean, Jimmy was these days we would call a pansexual being. You know, he loved sex. It didn't always have to be a beautiful young lady. So the minute you start pulling at the threads, you discover more and more and more about who this guy really was. And it seems to me, after all this time working on it and looking at it, that, and all the other books, and there are some very commendable books, but, you know, the pattern that emerges is that these books are written by pretty much white, middle-class journalists, over-concerned with music, over-concerned with what Pete Townsend might have thought of Jimi Hendrix or something like that, all of which is interesting and has its place, but just doesn't touch the depth of what this guy really was about, who he really was, what his motivations really were, his involvement with the Black Panthers, the fact that black people in America did not like his music, did not approve of him, the fact that he was booed off stage in Harlem because he was seen as an Uncle Tom, the money he gave to various causes, the impact Martin Luther King's death had on him. There's this whole, and to me it was mind-boggling to get into all this stuff and think, why hasn't anybody ever written about
it? But if you think about it, if you think about it, Mick, I mean it's a fair point, isn't it? Because excuse me, but if you think about that whole psychedelic experience, with very few exceptions, it seems to be, you know, brothers and sisters and the whole thing at Woodstock. Woodstock was presumably a white middle class thing. The whole hippie movement is predominantly, you can argue, a white middle class thing. And this whole Jim Crow thing.
Yeah.
Just think, at the same time, you have got the Black Panthers, you've got James Brown, you've got, you know, Say It Loud and Black and Proud. Everybody's, you know, getting on that whole civil rights kick.
Absolutely. And that's not to try and undersell the impact his music had, the impact that having a black American guy suddenly dominate this, what the time, mainly British white music rock scene. But the fact is, you know, when I was talking to Noel Redding before he died some years ago, he told me that Jimmy never saw himself as a black man. And that is such a ludicrous, insanely uninformed thing to say. Jimmy only saw himself as a black man. And even his own road crew to this day referred to him as an honorary white man. And you're kind of going, wow. I mean, what does that say about the racial mores of the late 60s and this so-called permissive time of acceptance and consciousness expanding? Hendrix was a mover and shaker. He'd signed tons of contracts for various people before he got to London. He would do anything he needed to do to make a buck, mm. because that's what it took to make it in that world, in America at that time. And I suspect still, you know, to this day, if you're a poor black boy in America coming from an utterly dysfunctional family background, how are you going to make it? Sports, music, hustling. So I just thought, you know, this is so much more interesting than the kind of Santa Claus fairy story we're told. I mean, my book publishers, when they start, there are no photos in the book. And the reason for that is all the photos they came up with were this kind of psychedelic Avenger in Carnaby Street. And I'm like, that is so just 1% of who this guy really was. And also this idea that, you know, oh, he died a sad death, he died too young. He died a terrible death. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But then that takes you to the place where people will say, well, what would have happened had he lived? Where would his music have taken him? That's a nonsensical question. The fact is, his music took him to his death. You know, his life, the moves, where would he have gone? To the grave. That's where he went. That's what was happening. There is no parallel universe where unicorns fly around and everybody lives in peace and Jimmy's still with us playing wonderful guitar. None of the artists of that era turned out that way. They all turned out either compromised, drug addicted, or dead. None of them make music now as good as they did 50 years ago. So you kind of go, look, these are silly, boring questions that only music journalists ask. You know,
yeah.
What's the truth? What is the truth? And
but
the truth, as always, is much bigger than what we realize.
It's a convenient timeline, isn't it, though? Because you go, you see, and then we lost the three brightest sparks. We lost Jimmy, we lost Janis, and then we lost Jim Morrison. And we had, yeah. And it's 50 years to the day almost of Altamont as well, I think. And, you know, and that yeah. was, and the Rolling Stones, you know, the Stones and their 69 tour. And therefore, that is the end of the, you know, flowers in your hair and, you know, getting on your unicorn and galloping off. So it makes a convenient timeline and a convenient coda, because then we get all nasty Led Zeppelin pop up, Black Panthers pop up, and you know, and things get much more confusing in the 70s.
Well, they do, but I think generally the world over, I mean, there's no doubt that there was a moment there in the 1960s, politically, socially, musically, culturally, where it was an extraordinary moment. There's no doubt about that. And I think, you know, lots of things come into play in terms of music, but 1968 becomes the first year that LP sales, album sales, overtake the sales of singles. And we forget now, we take it for granted, but back in 68, 69, when Hendrix had already released his last album in his lifetime, LPs were still a brand new phenomenon. Rock music was still, the Beatles were still being debated as to, does this stuff actually have any significance beyond ho-hum, ha-ha, hit single in the charts? You know, people were still talking on that level in those days. And so you can't undersell that fact. But the fact is, music itself at that point became, and into the early 70s, probably the most important, significant artistic movement of them all at that moment. More than film, more than painting, more than anything, music was what really, really fired people up, particularly young people, and got them thinking about reality and the world and their place in it. But the moment passes, and certainly the 70s in all the spheres becomes much more knowing, much less innocent. You know, you get Francis Ford Coppola with The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. You know, it's a very post-Hendrix world, if you like. So so the book tries to tell the story of Jimi Hendrix. It doesn't even tell you about his funeral. It doesn't talk about what happened next with his posthumous career, as it were. It begins on the day he's murdered, and it ends with the people that murdered him going off to do the deed. And everything in between is his life up to that point. But bringing in all these other, I mean, his relationship with Miles Davis, his relationship with Brian Jones, his relationship with the Mafia, the reality of Woodstock, which wasn't this glorious signing off moment for him. He came on stage 9 hours late after tripping for 3 days. 80% of the audience had already left. If you look at the pictures of him playing at 8:30 in the morning, the final guy at Woodstock, it's pitiful.
Yeah.
You know, there's hardly anybody there. Most of them are half awake. The rest have been up for days as well. Don't really know what's going on. And Jimmy puts on a great performance, but he looks ravaged. He looks crazed. The whole thing is kind of desperate, but we only see it through the eyes of him doing the Star Spangled Banner, which he'd been doing live for months at that point. You know, it wasn't a spontaneous 60s defining moment until it ends up on film a year later. So because he died, and it's like the Christ figure of rock, because the minute they die, the mythology takes over, and suddenly all the disciples start piling on with their versions of what really happened and how significant it was. But while Jimmy was alive, there was him and there was the rest of the world, and they were pretty much at war for most of it.
Talking about, I mean, here's one for you then, Mick, because you talk about the Star Spangled Banner, you talk about Machine Gun, for example, and those are seen as, and Killing Floor, these are seen as anti-Vietnam, having a huge effect. Does his music reflect Vietnam? Is he sucked into that? Or is that just sort of almost a sideshow because, you know, other artists are dealing with that, like Edwin Starr, more directly?
I think they, I mean, Machine Gun for sure, Star Spangled Banner, you know, it became very popular afterwards to talk about how that incredible pyrotechnic guitar improvisation he does around that tune sounds like, you know, the bombers in Vietnam, or the streaking of flamethrowers and so forth. There's no doubt he was addressing that, because at that moment in time, every important rock artist was obliged to address it, because that was, particularly in America, of course, that was the predominant question of the age. If you happen to be in your late teens or 20s, was, am I going to Vietnam? What is Vietnam about? What is my country about? Nixon gets elected in 1968 after Bobby Kennedy is assassinated, 2 months after Martin Luther King is assassinated. You know, this is a real flashpoint time. Mm. At the same time, Jimmy had friends that went to Vietnam. He had friends from the 101st Airborne that ended up going. And he was not so cut and dried on the subject of whether Vietnam was a war worth fighting or winning. He was more concerned with the people that had to go, whether they liked it or not. And we mustn't forget that as those soldiers were coming back, terrible things were happening to them. You know, they were treated like dogs. They had all kinds of terrible stuff thrown at them. They were beaten. They were despised. They were blamed for a war that made everybody so ashamed. And I think Hendrix's, if there was a message, or certainly his feeling, was that the Vietnam War is not as cut and dried as everybody. It's not us and them. It's us, and some of us are over there, and some of us aren't, but we're all in this together. Who knows what's going on, but it's some kind of hell.
You mentioned, obviously, the Hendrix connection, and again, it goes back to that whole thing of people thinking that, you know, the management are... Because you think of 60s management, and you think of, I don't know, sort of Dozy, Beaky Mick, and Titch's management, that sort of thing, but there's a dark underbelly, isn't there? There's a dark underbelly that's always been there. You think about the showbiz world and the London crime world, political crime world, all getting together, you know, with the craze and that sort of thing. And then you think about, you know, Hendrix, and you think about the Allman Brothers, and they had a few run-ins with the mob, to put it mildly. And then you think about, you know, you just said about the Gambinos. Now, Gambinos, you know, they were pretty much responsible for bringing heroin into the States as well, weren't they, in huge amounts?
The younger members, certainly. They had their own kind of youth rebellion going on there, and that involved bringing in heroin. Although the Mafia had actually been involved in the heroin trade for some years before that, but their quid pro quo was only to sell it to black people.
Yeah.
So as far as they were concerned, if it went to the black ghettos, that was fine, just as long as it didn't destroy other communities, which is incredibly kind of evil, hateful strategy. But that was theirs. And then the younger guys came in the 60s and said, why not just sell to everybody? Mm. Because at this point, so many white people, young people are taking drugs. This is the most profitable. Two and two makes four, you know. But the American music business, their connection with organized crime, they grew up together. The two grew up hand in hand, going all the way back to the days of Prohibition. The fact that the music business was always a cash business.
Well, you've only got to look at Sinatra, haven't you? And his thing, and him believing himself to be, you know, a made man.
Well, absolutely. And Sinatra's record label, Reprise, which becomes the label Jimi Hendrix is signed to by his own mob-connected manager, was run by Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers, which is now well-established, was the most mob-connected, mob-run label in America, and coincidentally, the biggest label in America. You know, but by the time you get to the 60s, the only difference is you've suddenly got this thing where all these entertainers, and there's almost every entertainer you could name, not just Frank Sinatra, but Frankie Valli, all kinds of people, smaller artists that would have 1 million selling single and make no money from it because the boys, as they called them, had taken all the money. They ruled the music business, and all that happened really by the time Jimmy comes along is that the sea change is artists writing their own songs, artists taking themselves seriously, artists themselves not just seeing what they did as a cash cow, but as a personal statement, as a career move, as something way beyond dollars and cents. And that set up a whole new way of thinking that really collided very heavily with the way the mob did business, which was you do what you're told, you make me some money, and I'll cut you a little bit. You know, suddenly these guys want to own their own songs, they want to own their own destiny. So that causes a great deal of conflict. And it wasn't, as you say, it wasn't just Jimi Hendrix that came a cropper because of that. In the UK, the music business as it grew up in the 50s and the 60s, run by men like Don Arden, Sharon Osbourne's father, these were the Wild West days. I mean, Don managed Little Richard, Gene Vincent, and then by the 60s, by the time Hendrix comes along, he'd managed the Animals before Mike Jeffrey did the dirty on him. He managed the Small Faces until Robert Stigwood came along and tried to take them, which is when Don famously got his henchmen and hung Robert over a balcony in Cavendish Square in London.
Right.
You know, Don used to carry a gun to all his meetings. And I ghosted Don's memoir. I worked with him for some time. He carried a gun to all his meetings. So did Mike Jeffrey, Jimi Hendrix's manager. These were the days when there were no camera phones, a corrupt police force that you could buy. And you would turn up, and it was who had the bigger guns, you know, who had the most muscle. And the artists would be on wages, kids happy to be on telly, happy to get the girls, happy to have the nice clothes. But the moolah, the bread, the lolly, that all went into the tailor-made pockets of all. I mean, and Don was mob-connected as well. He was Joe Pagliano, big mafia family in New York. You know, all these guys became connected one way or another. And over in the UK, of course, we had the Craze,
mm-hmm.
Also saw themselves as music, moving into the music business. But by the time the 60s come along, of course, they have other issues to worry about.
So who do you speak to, Mick, when you want to put something like this together? Because this is completely, I mean, as soon as you started off with Jimi Hendrix was murdered, you know, that was the sound of my, you know, my jaw hitting the desk. So, so you know, it's not a tale that I've heard before, but it kind of makes sense, believe it or not.
The odd thing is, all this stuff is out there hidden in plain sight. I mean, the internet it can be a wonderful tool in terms of searching for records. I mean, I was able to look up Mike's Army records. I was able to look up his family background, trace their beginnings from before the Second World War when Mike was born, trace his whole career after he left the army, the years he did with the British Secret Service, some of the places he went and the things he did. This stuff is out there. You just have to kind of get your walking boots on and your hunting gear on and go out and start looking. You also talk to people. The research turns up people that are still alive. And there are lots of people still alive that will tell you that all this stuff about Mike. Most of it, and I find this a lot with my books, it was the same with Led Zeppelin, it was the same with The Doors. So much of this stuff just gets ignored. There's quite often maybe one book that people go, oh, well, that's, you know, like Led Zeppelin, Hammer of the Gods. I mean, that came out nearly 35 years ago. Blimey. And people still talk about it as being kind of the book. You know, it was based on one interview with a tour manager and came out at a time before the internet, before we had all these wonderful documentaries, back in the days when, oh, my God, they had lots of groupies and took lots of drugs, was enough to sell a book, you know.
Halcyon days, Mick.
The Doors, people still talk about Jerry Hopkins and Danny Sugarman's No One Here Gets Out Alive. You know, that book's been discredited a million times. And I did my own Doors book. You suddenly realize what a load of fiction so much of it is, what a load of kind of wish list, fan site, crazy stuff a lot of that thing is. But the truth is much weirder, much stranger, but much harder to sift through and get to the bottom of, because so many of these books are written by fans. They're, you know, people mistake me for a fan. They go, you wrote a book on Metallica. I'm a huge Metallica fan as well. And I go, I wrote a book on Metallica. That doesn't make me a huge Metallica fan. That makes me a huge fan of telling stories and getting to the truth. You know, people often ask me, what do the groups think when they read your books? And my honest answer is, I don't care, because I didn't write the book for them. I write the book for us, Giles, you, me, and all the intelligent people out there that are sick of this rubbish and just want to get the truth. The problem is the truth is always complicated. The truth is always compromised, conflicted. The truth is always awkward. You know, there aren't bad guys and good guys. There's just what happened and why it happened and the world in which it happened. And if you can just kind of ignore everything that came before and not get at face value, actually get in there and sit there thinking about it and looking at all the evidence that is out there, if you just keep looking, you come away with it. And that's what I do. I come away with it then and try and put all those pieces together into what I feel is the closest version to the truth that I can discover. And it's not just done plainly. I mean, when I say the truth, I think these days, you know, we live in an on-demand culture. We watch box sets. We binge on box sets. We love films and stories that are multi-stranded, that don't just go A, B, C, D, E, because that isn't how life is. They begin with an explosion. They go backwards. They go forwards. They don't try and – they're not whodunits. You know, it's not a who's the bad guy, who's the good guy, how does this end well. None of it ends well, and there aren't any good and bad guys. Now, isn't that interesting? Okay, read on.
You've got me hooked. Yeah. Now, as I always say, we could talk about this for basically most of the rest of the year, I think, Mick. But unfortunately,
I love talking to you, Charles. I've done quite a few interviews for this book, and none of them. No one gives me the chance to talk about it properly like you do. They just want some handy sound bites. And I get that. I understand that. But I've said more to you just in this last conversation we've had than I've said to anybody about this book. And so I thank you for that. I'm so privileged and happy that you let me do that.
Listen, as I said before, we do this for a living and we get paid too. What could be a better way of living your life? What do you think, mate? What do you think that people will be able to take from the book? The music doesn't diminish, does it, after reading a book like Two Riders?
No. I mean, I would hope, if anything, it becomes enhanced, because it's not cast in aspic. It's not this kind of set in stone story everybody thought it was. So I would hope that they take from this book what I take when I from books that I read that blow my mind, just a kind of real astonishment, energy charge, just sheer delight in the fact that someone is taking the gloves off and getting really in there and not afraid to bring you back the real McCoy. That's always exciting, I think, in any story. And that's, I mean, I think this is the best book I've ever done. And I've done quite a few.
Exactly.
You've done a few, mate.
The book is called Two Riders Were Approaching the Life and Death of Jimi Hendrix. It's out now on Trapeze. It's by Mick Wall. Mick, people can find you, of course, on that internet thingy, can't they?
They certainly can. I've got a website I kind of let go to the dogs, to be honest. But right. You can find me on Facebook. I have an official Facebook page, personal Facebook page, Twitter, all that stuff. I'm very easy to find.
And only one more question then, because you've now taken the gloves off, Mick, and you've revealed that Hendrix, you know, the dark behind Hendrix. Please, please tell me, because I love your Lemmy book. I mean, I've read it twice now. Tell me that Lemmy was, in fact, an MI5 agent and brought down the Berlin Wall.
That's the next book, Charles. That's the next book.
The book is called Two Riders Were Approaching the Life and Death of Jimi Hendrix. It's by the great Mick Wall. Mick, it's been an absolute pleasure once again to speak to you.
And same back at you, Charles. Always a great pleasure to speak to you.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.